Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're taking a deep dive into something pretty complex and honestly quite costly: workers' compensation fraud. We've gathered, a bunch of sources, articles, some research, our own notes, trying to get to the heart of this deception that really affects everyone: businesses, employees, the public.
That's right. And our mission here really is to help you quickly get a handle on the core elements, like what is this fraud, legally speaking? And maybe understand a bit of the psychology behind why people do it, and then how it actually gets uncovered.
Because it's way more than just someone, faking a limb. It's got layers and big financial consequences.
Exactly. Huge. So to really get started, we need to know how the law sees it. What's the actual definition?
Our sources really zero in on the legal proof required, especially here in California. They mention insurance in 1871.4A and Penal Code 550A. So what actually needs to be proven?
Well, think of it like needing to clear, say, three big hurdles for it to legally be called fraud. First, the statement someone makes. It has to be made knowingly.
Knowingly. So they have to be aware it's false when they say it. No honest mistakes.
Precisely. No accidental slip-ups count. It's got to be deliberate. Second, the statement has to be material.
Material, meaning important,
Yeah,
relevant.
exactly. Important or relevant to the claim itself. Something that could, actually sway the decision about benefits, like how the injury happened, or maybe hiding past injuries.
Gotcha. So saying you hurt your back lifting boxes at work, when really it happened moving your couch at home, that's material.
That's a perfect example. That's material. And the third hurdle,
What's the third one?
intent. The statement has to be made with a specific goal or purpose of getting compensation you're not entitled to, or maybe denying benefits someone is entitled to.
Ah, intent. So proving what was going on in their head, that sounds tricky.
It often is. Proving intent beyond a reasonable doubt, that's usually the biggest challenge for prosecutors. It really is.
And here's something I found really interesting. In the sources, you can actually be prosecuted for attempted fraud.
Yes, that's a key point.
Even if the whole plan falls apart, no money changes hands. Just making that false material statement with the intent, that's enough.
It is. It's a critical legal tool, really aimed at deterrence. So, okay, that's the what. Now, maybe let's touch on the why. Like, why do people do this?
The psychology, the sources brought up the fraud triangle and the fraud diamond.
Yep, the classics. The triangle is pressure, opportunity, and rationalization. The diamond adds a fourth element, capability.
Okay, let's use that story from the sources. Joe, the new warehouse guy on probation, he claimed his softball injury happened at work, so there were no witnesses. How does the triangle fit him?
Well, his probation. That likely created the pressure, right? Fear of losing his job, maybe stress about medical bills for his actual injury.
Makes sense. High stakes for him.
Definitely. And the no witnesses part. That presented the opportunity, a gap, where he thought maybe nobody could contradict his story.
And the rationalization. He might tell himself, oh, it's a huge company, they won't miss it. Or maybe even, they owe me this, the job's tough, that kind of thing.
Exactly that kind of thing, justifying it internally. And then capability from the diamond model, that's his personal ability to actually do it, to come up with a lie, stick to it, seem convincing.
It's the skill to pull it off, basically.
Sort of, yeah, the personal traits to actually exploit that opportunity.
And, it's not just applicants like Joe doing this. Our sources were clear: fraud comes in different shapes.
Oh, absolutely. You've got things like provider fraud doctors or clinics billing for treatments that never happened. That can be incredibly costly.
Yeah, I bet.
And then there's employer fraud too, like a business owner lying about their payroll numbers or misclassifying workers to get lower insurance premiums.
Right, that cheats the whole system. So, okay, if it's happening in these different ways, how does it get uncovered? What tools do investigators use?
Well, the sources mentioned several things. Basic background checks are common. Using databases like edX or EAMS here in California to look for prior claims history. See if there's a pattern.
Looking for someone who maybe claims the same injury every couple of years.
Could be, yeah. Patterns like that. And social media, obviously, is huge now.
But investigators have rules there, right?
Strict rules. They can only use publicly available information, no hacking, no fake friend requests, and they have to collect metadata. The data about the data to prove when and where they found a post or photo.
Right. Got to be above board. What about surveillance? Like staking someone out?
That happens too. But again, strictly legal. It follows the plain view doctrine. They can only film what anyone could see in a public place. They're looking for inconsistencies, basically. Someone claiming they can barely walk, Then you see video of them, say, roofing their house.
Yeah, okay. Contradicting their own story or the medical reports.
Exactly. But often, the sources point out, the very first step is just prompt reporting by the employer and training staff to notice those initial red flags.
Okay, so let's pull back for the bigger picture. The cost. Our sources talk about billions nationally. California gets hit hard. It's a massive financial drain.
It really is. But here's the kicker. Despite how common it seems to be and how much it costs, the prosecution rate is low, like really low. Yeah, around, what was it, 3%?
3%. Yeah, that number jumped out at me too. Only 3% of claims lead to prosecution. Why so low?
Well, our sources suggest a few key reasons. We already mentioned one. That incredibly high legal bar of proving intent beyond a reasonable doubt. That's tough.
Right.
Plus limited resources. Investigative agencies, prosecutors, they often have huge caseloads. And some fraud schemes, especially the organized ones, are just really complex to unravel.
So, okay, let's try to wrap this deep dive up. We've seen that workers' comp fraud isn't just lying. It has specific legal hurdles, knowing it's false, being material, and having that intent.
Right. And even attempting it can get you prosecuted. We also touched on the psychology, like the fraud triangle, helping us understand the why.
And investigators have tools from database checks and careful social media snooping to actual surveillance, all looking for those contradictions.
But we also saw the flip side. This enormous cost versus a surprisingly low prosecution rate, largely because proving that intent is so challenging and resources are stretched thin.
Yeah, that 3% figure is really something. So here's maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Given that the whole system is meant to help workers who are genuinely injured, What does that low prosecution rate actually mean for the system's integrity? How do you strike that balance between keeping help accessible for legitimate claims while also deterring fraud that seems to be getting more sophisticated?
That's the $1 million question, isn't it? Or maybe $1 billion, yeah. Given the costs.
Exactly. Something to think about.